This continues Exodus from Egypt, The Hidden Agenda. This is tape 3 in the series. All right, tonight it falls to us the daunting task to try to bring these sessions to a close with some degree of coherency. I have every intention of succeeding in that. However, should we fail, I will ask you at the end of this class if there would be any possibility of doing an epilogue to be able to tie up the loose ends.
Definitely.
All right. Okay, so we'll talk about that if we have to. Okay? Okay. According to my recollection, I inadvertently didn't mention an important point, although I may be wrong. My recollection may fail me. It's not the first time, but if it fails me, then it failed Cass, too. the point I'm referring to is the unique character of the plague of hail, the plague of Barad. Did we talk about this at all?
No.
All right, so let's talk just a very little bit now. We talked a little bit last week about, and correct me if I'm wrong, about the uniqueness of Pharaoh's response to the plague of hail, did we not?
Yes.
Pharaoh's response to the plague of hail is different than his response to any other plague thus far. As a matter of fact, I even remember getting into an argument with Searle over this. Pharaoh's response to the plague of hail is Hashem atzadik vaniva ami harasha'im chatati hapa'am. He says, I have sinned this time. God is the righteous one, and me and my people are the wicked ones. There are a couple interesting things to note here before we even look at the plague itself. First of all, if you look throughout all of the plagues, and if you look at the omniscient narrator's characterization of Pharaoh's refusal to let the Jews go, when is the first time that the omniscient narrator makes a value judgment as to whether or not Pharaoh has done a good thing or a bad thing by not letting the Jews go? Quick trivia question here. In all the plagues, if you can open your chumashim, you can look at this, take a quick scan through, right? After various plagues, the narrator says, and Pharaoh hardened his heart, or and God hardened his heart, and Pharaoh still didn't let the people go. But there's no value judgment there. All it is a portrayal of the facts that Pharaoh decided not to let the Jews go, and he changed his mind. However, is there any time that the omniscient narrator actually makes a comment as to whether Pharaoh was doing a good or bad thing by changing his mind? See if you can identify that. You can start from chapter 5 all the way through chapter 10. Quick scan. The question is, Pharaoh decides not to let the Jews go 9 times, right? After the first 9 plagues, right? In each of those times, the omniscient narrator tells us that Pharaoh decided not to let the Jews go. Usually, the omniscient narrator does not comment. That actually is one of the greatest, one of the marks of the Torah as great literature, by the way, that poor literature feels a poor writer will need to tell you, right, what value judgments you're supposed to be arriving at. So every once in a while it'll put in. The Torah very rarely makes value judgments about characters as to whether they're doing good things or bad things. It leaves that up to you to decide. There are some occasional rare instances where the Torah does make value judgments. For example, when Esav sold his birthright, and he very quickly ate and ran, as it were. So in addition to saying that Esav ate and ran, the Torah makes a value judgment and adds, Vayivez Esav et habechora, and Esav thereby despised or scorned the birthright. Okay, but that is a value judgment that the Torah almost never makes, right? The Torah makes another one of those value judgments with Pharaoh, but only once, as far as I can tell, in the plagues. Chapter 9, verse 34. Vayar paro ki chadal hamatar vabarad. Pharaoh saw that the barad was over, vakolot, and the thunder was over, vayosef lachto, and he continued to sin. Vayachbed libo, and he hardened his heart, he and his servants. Okay, huvavadav. That is the only time, to my knowledge, that the omniscient narrator says that Pharaoh sinned. Isn't that remarkable? You think about Pharaoh, he's this really arch-villain, he's super bad guy, and only once does the omniscient narrator say that he sinned. Fascinatingly, it's after Barad. Yeah. Chapter 9, verse 34. After the plague of Barad, after the plague of hail. So my question to you is, why do you think this is the only place that the omniscient narrator said that Pharaoh sinned? Certainly this isn't the only time that Pharaoh changes his mind. The answer must be because Pharaoh just said he sinned. So fascinatingly, the omniscient narrator is not willing to say that Pharaoh sinned until Pharaoh himself says that Pharaoh sinned. A few verses earlier, Pharaoh, in response to Barad, in response to the plague of hail, says, I have sinned this time, right? The Lord is righteous and me and my people are wicked. Then he changes his mind, and then the omniscient narrator says, and now Pharaoh has sinned. So interestingly, it is only after Pharaoh says that he sinned that the omniscient narrator is willing to say that he sinned. Okay, this is an important point to keep in mind. Now, there would seem to suggest, if this is right, that something funny is going on with the plague of Barad, with the plague of hail. I mean, for some reason or another, it is only there that Pharaoh considers himself to have sinned, and it's only there that the omniscient narrator considers Pharaoh to have sinned in a just in an absolute way, in a way that there's really no wiggle room. So the question is, what is it about, is there any indication that the plague of Barad was unique in any kind of way? Usually we think of the 10th plague as the unique plague, and all the other ones were just sort of, window dressing, sort of. But there is something apparently unique about the plague of hail. You'll see it, by the way, in the prologue to the plague of hail. When God speaks about the plague of hail, you even get a sense from God that this plague is different than all of the other plagues. See if you can identify that verse. It's in chapter 9, verse 14. Okay? Listen to this. Thus says God, this is what you should say, send forth my people that you should that they may serve me. Keep a palm hazot, because this time ani shaleach et kol magrifotai alibcha. This time I'm going to unleash it all. I'm going to send forth all of my plagues into your heart. Very interesting words, by the way, considering the prominence of Pharaoh's heart in this whole story. This turn of phrase probably is not accidental. Where are these what are these plagues going to afflict? More than just afflicting the land, they're going to afflict your heart. Right? Ani shaleach et kol magevotai alibcha. I'm sending all my plagues to your heart, ubavadecha, and your servants, ba'avur teida ki ein kamoni b'chol aretz, so that you should know that there is no one like me, that I'm absolutely unique throughout the land. So God seems to put special stock in the plague of hail. Okay? And indeed, the response to the plague of hail is unique. And the omniscient narrator's response to the plague of hail is unique. What was so unique about the plague of hail? I'd like you to take 2 minutes and read through the plague of hail, and I'd like to see if you can identify for yourselves one or two elements about hail that seem to make it absolutely unique that you do not find from other plagues. Okay, you can do this in Chavrusas if you like. You can do it alone, giving you 120 seconds. On your mark, get set, go. Okay, your time is up. Okay, folks, what is unique about the plague of Barad?
I've never been there before.
True. However, why would that not be unique to hail? Because it's true that there is no hail like this ever before, but when was the last time the Nile turned to blood either? Right? Or when was the last time you had frogs like this? Now, each plague represents an extreme version of this thing. Egypt has never seen anything like any plague. So that's true that the hail is unique with reference to any other hail, but that doesn't make it unique with reference to every other plague. Yeah?
He gives an opportunity for those that are Egyptian to potentially protect themselves from the plague.
Right. So there is a warning of how you can avoid the effects of the plague. This is the only plague that comes along with a warning of how you can get out of it if you wish. Okay? God says that if you want, you can, people who are accepting God in their hearts can seek shelter. Right now, it'll still destroy the crops. That's true, but right. But at least it's not going to get the cattle, and it's not going to get the people. So that there is at least a warning as to how you can minimize the effects of the plague if you choose. So that seems to be unique. Yes.
The Barad itself is not just Barad; it's a combination of ice and fire.
Right. Okay. There's a combination of ice and fire raining down. According to Mefarshim, the hailstones themselves had fire inside of them. Either that, or literally fire and ice were raining down at the same time. Okay, that would be in that same verse that Lori suggested, which is verse 24. Okay, so there seem to be two unique... Now, let me ask you this. So why is that unique? I'm going to play devil's advocate. Every plague is unique. Again, when was the last time you saw blood? The whole Nile turned to blood. That never happened. So why is this any more unique than that? Everything's supernatural here. Yeah.
But the fire and ice represent opposites. Two opposites that are combined.
Okay, good. Fire and ice represent opposites. Right? This is the first plague in which you seem to have opposites coexisting in a certain area. Okay? Good. So now let's just stop for a moment. We're going to do a little mathematical equation here. Okay? We're going to do input and output. All right? In the plague of Barad, if we were to flow chart the plague of Barad, we would say the input is that this is a plague that comes with a warning of how you can minimize the effects of the plague, and it's a plague that comes with fire and ice together in the same plague. That is the input. The output is that Pharaoh's response is that he has sinned, and his people have sinned, and God is the righteous one, and the people are wicked. The first time Pharaoh responds that way, and afterwards the omniscient narrator is willing to say that he has sinned. Now the question is, why is it that that input should match that output? In other words, what is there about those particular things, about the uniqueness of what Barad represented, that might precipitate, pardon the pun, the response of Pharaoh in that particular kind of way? That is a problem. It's not a problem, but that is an issue that we will resolve, hopefully, in just a few moments.
The fire and ice, the first really supernatural...
Well, not really. One second. Remember that the sorcerers have long ago given up being able to do any of this. And they've said, Etzba Elohim hi, right? This is the finger of God. So there seems to be a recognition that something supernatural was going on. It's not like, at least if you read the text, it doesn't seem like everybody thought this was just another day in Egypt and, you know, just a big windstorm or something going on. So it doesn't seem to be the thing that convinces people that it's supernatural. They already seem to be convinced that it's supernatural, so it must be something else. So this is an interesting question. How does this input match that output? That's something we're going to get to. Okay, let me go back to your homework question, the issues which we left you with last week. That were the issues of God's name. I mentioned to you last week that the Exodus story seems to be unique in all of Tanakh as the only story in which God seems particularly concerned with his name, what name that he's called, what he's called with. We mentioned that this seems particularly confusing because God seems to change his mind several times about what name he's supposed to be called. When he's at the burning bush and Moses asks him his name, God says, "What are you asking me my name for?" Right? And he says, and he answers, he says, "I am that which I am, and say I am sent me to you." And then God seems to change his mind and say, Hashem Elokei Avotecham Shlachani Aleichem, Zeh Shmi Lo'olam V'Zeh Zichri L'Dor V'Dor. The God of your forefathers sent me to you, that's my name forever. So here Moses, you might be a little confused, you know, which is the name? Is the name I am that I am? Is it just I am, which is the second version? Is it the third version, which is that the God of your forefathers, that's the name? What exactly is the name? Now, if we're not confused enough, God gets back into the names and gives us a whole new slate, right, just a couple chapters later in the beginning of Parshat Va'era, when God says that, let's see if we can find it. He says, Ani Hashem, I am Hashem, Yudke Vavke. Va'era el Avram el Yitzchak el Yaakov bekel Shakai, and I revealed myself to Abraham and Isaac as El Shaddai, Ushmi Hashem, but my name Hashem, Yud Hey and Vav Hey, Lo No Dati Lahem, I did not make known to them. So God seems to be revealing himself as Hashem, that special name of God, Yud Hey and Vav Hey, and he is not, and yet, before he's spoken of himself in other, with other names. So how is it that we understand that? All right, folks, it is at this moment that I'm going to let the cat out of the bag as to my theory on what's going on here. And the theory is very much tied up with these names of God. What we're going to try and do is try to discern what it is that these names mean. I think we talked last week about the name Elohim, right? We talked about that. So the name Elohim signifies God as a power with a small p, right? It is a generic name for God. That's why judges are called powers. The name Elohim just means power. That's why idols are called powers. Don't believe in any other powers is really what it means in the Ten Commandments. But we also have this name Yud-Heh and Vav-Heh, and what does that mean? And we're also talking about Kel Shakai and what that means. So God says, until now, I've revealed myself as Kel Shakai, right? But not as Yud-He and Vav-He. So what is it that God might mean about that? Now, I'm not a mystic, but I'll give you the Midrashic interpretation of Shaddai. Again, the Midrashic interpretation of Shaddai is Sha'omer La'olamo Dai, the God who was able to say to the world, enough. Right? Now, the rabbi said this 2,000 years ago, but what does it mean, Sha'omer La'olamo Dai? The sages seem to have seen Shaddai as a name that expresses great power, and the power is expressed in God saying to the world, enough. What does it mean for God to say to the universe, enough? Yeah.
Well, and you had alluded to that last year in the class, that it's within the constructs of nature, that there's a limitations to nature. And I mean, what they're saying actually is that when you work within, what God does within the actual bounds.
Okay, good. The notion of limitations to the laws of nature, or that the laws of nature are inherently limitations, is what is conveyed by that name Shaddai, or Sha'omer La'olamo Dai. Let's bring that down to earth. For a moment. Oftentimes I think that when we feel quite smugly that when we live in the age of modern science, we know so much more than the ancients did, that we've achieved somehow vanquished our naivete a little bit about the creation story and things like that. Certainly there's, I think, some hubris in the secular scientific community about that. Certainly the Bible is not seen as a great repository of scientific wisdom, and indeed I don't think it was meant as a scientific book. But one fascinating thing is the following, is that when you look at the headlines that described the advent of the Big Bang Theory, there was a lot of discussion at the time of whether the Big Bang could be true or could not be true. It was eventually all but proven through radio signals, which were detected, which were literally the residue of the Big Bang, the 3K background hum, which was predicted that if there was an explosion, that the radiation from that would still be around. And scientists, actually, I believe in 1973, detected that background hum. First they thought it was just static and noise in their instruments, and then they were trying to figure out where from the universe it was coming from, and they managed to find out that it in fact was coming from everywhere, that no matter where they turned their instruments, they were getting the same noise, and it wasn't friction. It wasn't just static, but it was this radiation, which was really everywhere. So the headlines around the time was, well, the first verse at least of Genesis has been confirmed. You know, there was a beginning, rather than the universe having existed forever. But the conventional wisdom, I think, since then is the notion that, well, there was a beginning, but the Big Bang was a huge chaotic event, right? And eventually order just kind of formed out of that. If you look at the theories of modern astrophysics, how is it that the universe coalesced after the Big Bang? So it goes roughly like this. Here's your quick astrophysics course, right? But basically what happens is there's this huge explosion where all of the matter of the universe is condensed into the size smaller than a subatomic particle, and for some reason or another it explodes. No one knows why. It's a scientific singularity. And in the moments and the years after the explosion, everything is extremely hot, everything is at first in the form of energy. As a matter of fact, it's so hot that light is not even there. The universe is dark for several hundred million years, and when things cool down enough that the energy actually makes it into photons, then all of a sudden the universe becomes full of light from the energy of this Big Bang. Remember that famous verse in Genesis, "Vayhi Or," right after creation, and then the universe cools further, and some of the energy begins to condense into matter, and you've got hydrogen atoms, and then you've got other atoms, and what happens is that you've got mostly hydrogen clouds, which begin to condense. And those hydrogen clouds eventually start coming together into clusters. And those clusters, the gravitational pull of the clusters are pulling them closer and closer together. And eventually what happens after another several hundred million years is that some of these clusters, the gravitational pull becomes so strong and there's so much friction inside these clouds of hydrogen that nuclear fusion begins, and you actually have nuclear furnaces beginning to ignite, and we call these stars. Stars are important because in a universe that was only full of hydrogen, you couldn't at that point get all of the other elements which eventually were going to be in the universe, specifically carbon and the other heavier elements which are so important for life, which did not exist in the early universe. How do you have carbon? You have carbon because after many more hundreds of millions of years, when you have stars burning for a while, what happens? Eventually the star will expend its nuclear energy, and at that point the gravity of the cloud will collapse it even further, and the star, which is still quite hot, as it collapses further, will then supernova. When it supernovas, the temperatures that are reached in supernovas are so great that that serves as a sort of nuclear kiln, and it takes the hydrogen atoms and it fuses them into all the heavier atoms, and that's where we get carbon and other elements. They all come from supernovas, and the supernovas explode and they send them into the far reaches of space, and now you have heavier elements. Those heavier elements then coalesce through the force of gravity to begin to form planets and protoplanets that then orbit these stars, and you begin to have solar systems and a universe which is hospitable for life. Now, that sounds... What's that? That's how it happens.
Okay.
What's that? Right. So it sounds not much work, right? You just got to get your first Big Bang going, and then voila, everything else, you know, happens after that. So that's basically the theory, okay, of how everything came to be. All right. Now, again, the way I've described it, it sounds pretty pat. All you really need is a good Big Bang to get things started, and then gravity kind of takes care of the rest. Just give it a few hundred billion years and, you know, and you're all set. Now, here's the problem. The problem is that I presented a very oversimplified picture, okay? And scientists over the last couple decades have begun to realize just how oversimplified that picture is, and it's begun to get people very nervous. Here is the problem, okay, in a nutshell. What kind of explosion was the Big Bang? Was it an ordered, coherent explosion, or was it a violent, run-of-the-mill, chaotic explosion? One would imagine it was a violent, run-of-the-mill, chaotic explosion. First of all, explosions by their nature tend to be violent and chaotic. Certainly an explosion that packs all the energy in the universe into one little piece and explodes outward has got to be the most violent and chaotic of explosions. Now, what if I told you that after you left here tonight, somebody was going to plant a grenade in this room, and the grenade was going to explode, okay? And you were asked to examine or to bet on the shrapnel displacement of that grenade afterwards. You're going to come in the room and you're going to look at all the shrapnel, okay? Now, are you likely to see a row of nails neatly across the roof right here, then another row of nails just exactly below them neatly across the roof? Is that the way the shrapnel is going to look? No, what's it going to look like? It's going to look like a mess, right? It's going to look like the biggest chaotic thing you've ever seen in this room. It's not going to look very ordered. So we'd expect that most bangs are like this. There is a problem, however. And the problem is that if this bang did not adhere to certain levels of order, we would not have a universe as I described it. Now, the time does not permit me to make a long presentation of exactly why this is true. There are at least 13 parameters that scientists have defined that had to be perfectly defined at the moment of the Big Bang, or else we wouldn't have a universe. But just to give you a little flavor of what it is that I'm talking about, let me give you two, okay? And I'll recommend for just one of the books that you can read, this book, Universes by John Leslie, which I mentioned to you last week. This guy, by the way, is not a religious man. He's a regular philosopher and scientist and astrophysicist. And here's what he says. Other books, Paul Davies would be The Mind of God, another book that discusses this. Another book would be Just Six Numbers by Rees, R-E-E-S. Okay, here's problem number one. Problem number one is what was the rate of expansion of the universe at early moments, in the early seconds after the Big Bang? How fast was stuff expanding? Well, it was expanding very fast, right? You just had a huge explosion. Things are going at tremendous speeds all over the place. Okay, the problem is the following. Remember, what force is it that is making all of these hydrogen clouds come together into stars? It is gravity. Okay. Now, gravity has a certain defined strength, right? Now, that has some implications for how fast the universe had to be expanding. What if the universe was expanding too fast? What would happen? Let's say the universe was expanding very, very fast.
Gravity couldn't overcome the
rate of expansion. It's like a rocket ship. When the rocket ship goes fast enough, it can attain an escape velocity and get out of the other orbit of Earth and break free of gravity. So too, if the universe had an escape velocity, if it was going too fast, it would overcome the force of gravity, and what would happen was everything would become so diffuse that there would be no clouds of hydrogen, there would be no stars, and there would just be a bunch of hydrogen atoms scattered throughout space, and that wouldn't have done anybody any good. Okay, let's think about this. Let's say the expansion rate of the universe were too slow. Okay, let's just say that the universe is expanding too slow. What would happen then? It would all compress. It would collapse. Right, the force of gravity would be so strong that it would just cause everything to go whump, right, and it will collapse unto itself. All right. Now you think, all right, fine. So obviously there's this middle range here, and it can't be too fast and it can't be too slow. So there's a nice, comfortable middle range, right, of how fast the universe had to be expanding or not. Now, what if I told you that the middle area where you would have a universe, again, if it's too fast, there's no universe. If it's too slow, you have a universe, right? Let's take, let's say that the rate of expansion, right, couldn't have been, if it was 10% greater, we wouldn't have a universe. And if it was 10% smaller, we wouldn't have a universe, right? Would that be impressive to you? I mean, then we got pretty lucky. We got, you know, we had a 1 in 10 chance of having a universe, right? So you'd say we lucked out. But what if I told you that it was actually 1%? That if it was 1% faster or 1% slower, we wouldn't have a universe. Then what would you say? You'd say, well, that sounds a little fishy. But what if I told you that it was 1 in 1,000? Okay, it was really 1 in 1,000. In other words, if it was 0.1% faster, there's no universe. Or 0.1% faster, then there is also slower than there's no universe. Would that be impressive? We then think something must be going on, right? Generally in statistics, the ratio for something that's considered statistically improbable, that is no longer reasonable to consider chance, the ratio is generally considered 1 in 1,000. Okay, when people get really frum, they make the ratio 1 in 10,000. So if I told you that if I changed this in one part in 10,000, right, one way or the other, then you would really have to suggest that something fishy was going on. Okay. Well, what actually is the rate? Is it 1 in 10, is it 1 in 10, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000? Okay, the difference, the safe zone, is such that if you change the rate of expansion, greater or lesser, to the ratio of 1 in 10 to the minus 55th power, okay, you have no universe. Now, let me explain to you what 10 to the minus 55th power is. Okay, 10 to the minus 1 would be 1 part in 10. 10 to the minus 2 would be 1 part in 100. 10 to the minus 3 would be 1 part in 1,000. 10 to the minus 4 would be 1 part in 10,000. Right? 1 part in 1,000,000, 10 to the minus 6th. 1 part in 10,000,000, 10 to the minus 7th. Okay? You can't even say the number of 10 to the minus 55th power. Right? To give you an idea of how big that number is, how many atoms do you think there are in the universe? Atoms in the universe. Right, 10 to the 71st power, right, is suggested. So you're talking about something on the order of atoms in the universe, right? One atom more, one atom less, that much, right? That is your safe zone for universe. Okay, again, this is not Foreman saying this. This is John Leslie and everybody else saying this, okay? But that is only one of 13 parameters that had to be this way, just to give you a second parameter that had to be this way. Not just the rate of expansion, but what's called the smoothness problem. The smoothness problem is the organization of the universe as it exploded. For example, the clumpiness of the explosion. As we said before, every explosion you would expect to be clumpy. Now let's say the explosion yielded clumps of matter that were too clumpy. What would happen if you had if the explosion made things too clumpy? What would then happen? What's the problem?
Lumpy universe.
What's wrong with a lumpy universe? What's wrong with a lumpy universe is because when you have too much matter together and too much matter comes together, that is a very bad thing. Do you know what we call this? We call this a black hole. Okay? When you have too much matter coming together, the gravitational forces become so strong that it just keeps on imploding into itself and nothing can escape even light, and you don't get a star. You get nothing but a useless black hole, which is really good for nothing as far as stars and supernovas are concerned. Okay? So if you have a universe that is too clumpy, you have a universe entirely of black holes and you have no stars whatsoever. Okay, but we have another problem. Let's say the universe is not clumpy enough. Okay, it's too smooth. What else is the problem? Let's say your universe is too smooth. It's like exactly even, right? Nothing will come together because everything is in such tension, mutual tension, that nothing can come together and clump even into stars. So if it's too clumpy, you've got a universe of black holes. If it's not clumpy enough, then you don't even get stars. So either way, you get no life. Okay, again, right, what are your chances? What is your safe zone? Again, your safe zone, again, is back in the range of 10 to the minus 60th, 10 to the minus 50th power. Right, in this, and parameter after parameter, in the particle masses, in the ratio of the force of electromagnetism to gravity, and parameter after parameter, right, things look very, very fishy. If you change one of these things to the smallest infinitesimal part in the first seconds after the Big Bang, you have no universe at all. I'm not talking about no Earth. I'm talking about no planets. I'm talking about no stars, no nothing. Okay? Now, this, I believe, gives new meaning to what it means, sha'amr la'olam odai, right? The God that said to the world, enough, right? In the sense of what you were suggesting, which is to define the parameters of the laws of nature, right? Because the laws of the nature have to be very, very exact in order for life to be what it was. What God has to say is to say enough, which is to sort of stop the random, unfolding, chaotic nature of things. If you think about it for a you can think about it for a moment in these terms, that one of the great dichotomies in Jewish thought is between compassion and justice. For those of you who are here, the series that I did on the Book of Jonah about a year and a half ago, right? I think that's what the book revolves around, the tension between compassion and justice. The way God deals with us, that's also a tension, compassion and justice. Ultimately, compassion is about spawning life and a desire to foster life at all costs. What justice is about saying, well, not here, not here, and not here, and cutting that off, and cutting off potential. You see it, by the way, in also, I think, the word emet, the word for truth, right? Chot Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, emet, God is called the God of truth. If you look at emet, emet also, right, it can be seen as a amalgam of two words, aim and mate. What does aim mean? Mother. What does mate mean? Death. Right? What truth is the tension between motherhood and death. In other words, what motherhood is the feminine desire to foster life, right, at all costs. What mate is the opposite of that, is the cutting off and the death of things. Right? And even in biology, you have that notion of cells, that if cells reproduce in an unlimited way, we call that cancer. Right? However, so there's got to be a self-destruct mechanism in the cell which tells it when it's enough and when it needs to die. Right? That is the death part of it. When you have the two together, then you have real life. So it is in the universe. If you would think of the greatest act of compassion, the greatest act of a free outpouring of life-giving sustenance, you probably couldn't think of a greater example than the Big Bang itself. Right? Nothing started. The Big Bang was a singularity. By definition, nothing caused it. It just happened. And it happened only in order that the universe could be, right? Nothing caused it. It didn't exist in a world of justice. Nevertheless, justice is there, or death is there, in the sense of this very structured ordering of what comes out of that. So there is the word, so Kel Shaddai, so Kel means power, and Shaddai also means power. Sha'amar lo lamodai. When God manifests himself, so to speak, as Kel Shaddai, he is manifesting himself as a powerful force, as perhaps the most powerful force. However, God seems to say that that is not enough and that the Exodus is designed to teach something more. What it's designed to teach is that God is Hashem, Yud Heh and Vav Heh, or what I would like to suggest to you is that a synonym for that is Ehayah Asher Ehayah, I will be that which I will be. Okay? Now let's talk about those two names for a moment. Ehayah Asher Ehayah, I will be that which I will be, and I am that I am. Let's talk about I am that which I am first, or I will be that which I will be. What was God saying there? Let's play God and Moses for a moment, a little role-playing game, okay? Let's say somebody asked you your name, okay? And your answer was, I am what I am. Would you say that is a good answer? No. That's not a good answer. We might even say that I'm evading the question, right? If you say, I am that I am. What did God mean when he's saying, I am that I am? Did he answer Moses, or did he evade the question? Now, if he was really trying to evade the question, he should have said something else. What should he have said? He should have said, why are you asking my name? Right? We actually have an example of that in the Torah. Where do we have an example of that? In the Torah, where someone asks for a heavenly being for a name, and the heavenly being responds by rejecting the request and saying, why is it that you're even asking for my name? With Yaakov and the angel. When Yaakov asks the angel for his name, the angel says, I'm not telling, why are you asking my name? That's an illegitimate question. Now, God does not say it's an illegitimate question, but so he doesn't really evade the question, but nevertheless, he seems to give a non-answer. He says, I am that which I am, or I will be that which I will be. Now let's analyze this a bit further. Let's say someone again asks you your name, right? What is it? First of all, what are you doing when you ask someone their name? What are you trying to do?
Yeah. What you're saying is you can't be defined.
Okay, you're trying to understand him. You're trying to define him. Whenever you name someone something, you're really seeking to define them, to peg them. When we name things, we do that because we have something that is unknown. And when we give it a name, we feel much more secure because now we think we know what we're talking about. So it's actually a very, very interesting phenomena when people have these strange medical conditions, right? And awful things are happening, God forbid. And the doctor will tell them, well, this is what you have. And then gives them a long Latin-sounding name that the person actually feels comfortable because at least it has a definition. I mean, I may not know what it is, but, you know, we've pegged it. Now it's no longer the great unknown, but it is something. But when I'm looking for a name, I'm looking to understand the thing. I'm looking to define it. Now, if someone said, give me a definition of a word. Let's imagine we're writing dictionaries now. And someone says, give me a definition of a word, right? There are rules for definitions, okay? There are rules for writing good definitions. You don't want definitions that are too long. You don't want definitions that are too wordy. But there is one cardinal rule for definitions that you cannot violate.
The word and the definition.
You cannot use the word that you are seeking to define in your definition. That is the worst thing you can do in definition. Every second grader knows that you can't define a word in terms of itself. You can't use the word in definition because if I knew what that word meant, I wouldn't be looking it up in the dictionary in the first place. Okay? We call this also a tautology when I define something in terms of itself. Right? Which makes what God said a really lousy answer. Because if Moses was seeking a definition when he said, God, who are you? And he said, I am that which I am, right? Then God has violated the cardinal rule of definitions, which is to never define something in terms of itself. Now, what was God actually saying when he said, I am that which I am? Yeah?
That you can't define it. You'll find out when I will be what I will be, you will find out as you see what I do. But if you're not going to define me...
Well, hold on for a second. I think that was self-contradictory. Because you'll find out, right, means that you can define me. It's just you haven't seen it yet. I mean, if you'll find out, then I'm defined. I'm just defined in terms of what you'll see. It's a little bit more than that. Right, what is he saying? Yeah.
I'm limitless.
Okay, so why doesn't he just say, you want to know who I am? I am Mr. Limitless. Right? That's what I am. I am Mr. Limitless. I mean, he could have said that. We have words for that in Hebrew. We call it Ein Sof in Kabbalah. He could have said, oh, me? You're talking about Ein Sof. That's my name. But he doesn't quite say that. Why is it, what would it mean for God not to be evading the question, but to say, I am that which I am?
Maybe it's the same. I'm not sure that my essence will depend upon the meaning that you find in me.
No, because he doesn't say that. He doesn't say, I am that which you want me to be. Right? He's saying, I am that which I am, not that which you see in me. I mean, because he could have said, I am that which you see in me. He says, I am that which I am, which is the cardinal rule that you never do in definitions. What he's actually saying is A equals A, okay, which is axiomatically true.
Basic, then you can't get any, you can't break down that thing that is so...
Okay, right. Okay, so let's figure this out. If I tell you, I am that which I am, and I'm really being honest with you, okay, then I am telling you something very fundamental. Whenever we define something, I'd like you for a moment to give me, and it might seem trivial, but bear with me for a second. I want you to give me a definition of a definition for a moment. What does it mean to define something, right? What does it mean to define something? Why is it that we use, what is it that we're doing when we use words to define something? Yeah?
To give it meaning.
We give it meaning. Now, how do we give it meaning? We give it meaning by describing it in terms other than it is. In other words, other than the word itself. In other words, the word itself is something we name. Now, what is it that we're saying? Let's say we're looking up a word in the dictionary, and we don't know what the word means. We're looking up Ergelschnorp in the dictionary. Nobody knows what Ergelschnorp means, so we look it up. What does it say? Well, if you want to know what Ergelschnorp means, so it is, you know, a red conglomeration of, you know, points upon a line, right? So you know what red is. Right, you know what conglomerations are, you know what points are. So what you're doing is that you're taking things that we can all relate to. We can all relate to red, right? We can all relate to lines. We can all relate to this. And what you're doing is you're saying, if you want to understand this thing which you think is unknown, all you have to do is go to your vast reservoir of knowledge of things that you've experienced in life. I'll tell you three or four things that you've experienced that you know, and you put those three or four things together, and then you'll understand what this is. Okay, that's what we do when we give a definition of something. Now, what if someone said that it's absolutely impossible? I am that which I am. You know what they're saying? What they're saying is that there is nothing in your experience which you can put together which will remotely describe me. Right? I cannot tell you to look at thing X, Y, and Z in your experience and put it together and you have me, because what I am is something so profoundly different than anything in your experience that you can't, that it doesn't mean anything. It would be meaningless for me to say, look at X, Y, and Z and you get me. Rather, therefore, I am that which I am. The only thing that would remotely describe me is me itself. But nothing else that is in your experience. That's what I am that I am means. Let's look for a moment at Yud-He and Vav-He. Now, what word, if we would put this all together, would this look like? What words does this look like this is composed of? Okay. How do you say, how do you say in Hebrew is? Something is. Oveh. How would you say was? Right? Hayah. And how would you say future? Yihyeh. Okay. All right, now, there seems to be some relationship between these words over here on the right and this word over here. Now, what I would like to suggest, there are some translations that will translate Yud-He and Vav-He as eternal, the eternal one, okay, based upon its similarity to was, is, and will be. I would like to argue on that interpretation for a moment, and I would like to suggest that that is not the best interpretation. Here's what I would like to suggest. That what Yud-He and Vav-He actually means, Jewish tradition has it that this is the name for God. In other words, all other names describe attributes of God, so to speak, whereas this describes the essence of God. What is it that it means that this describes the essence of God? Interestingly, the Rambam suggests that we cannot really know anything about God's essence, right? For the same reason that I am that which I am, which is there is nothing within our experience which remotely comes close to anything within God's experience. So therefore, we cannot describe his essence. So Rambam says we cannot say anything about God. All we can say are negative things about God. We can say he is not X, he is not Y, but we can't say positive things about him. There's only one positive thing that we can say about him, and that is that he exists. Okay, and that's it. This name seems to speak of God's existence, but it seems to, so to speak, define God's existence in a certain way. It defines God's existence as Yud-He and Vav-He, asking you to refer to these three things, Hayah, Hoveh, and Yihyeh. Now, what I would like to suggest to you is the following. Is there a word in Hebrew for existence that is spelled Yud-He and Vav-He, other than the name of God? In other words, does this have meaning other than the name of God?
Havaya.
No. Havaya would be spelled like this. Right? Havaya would be spelled like that, okay, which would mean existence. There is no word Yud-He and Vav-He. There is a word in the Torah, El, right? Power. But it means something. The word Yud-He and Vav-He doesn't mean anything. It looks close to Haya. It looks close to Hoveh. It looks close to Yihyeh, but it in fact is neither of these. What I would like to suggest is, what is it? Imagine for a moment that we had transparencies here, and I could create a transparent projection on a screen, and I would take a transparency of Hayah and lay it over Hoveh and lay it over Yihyeh. What would I have? I would have a Yud-He and a Vav and a He. What to me that suggests, and this is my theory, what to me that suggests is that what it means for God to exist is to experience all of this together as if it were overlaid. Okay? Now, is there a being that experiences time this way as Yud-He and Vav-He? Do you know of any being that experiences time this way other than God? No. How do we experience time? Well, if we're in the past, we're in the past. If we're in the present, we're in the present. If we're in the future, we're in the future. We are either in Hayah, or Hoveh, or Yihyeh. There is no such thing as being in Yud-He and Vav-He, right? Because there is no such being that experiences time that way. Now, what characteristic would a being have to have to experience time as Yud-He and Vav-He?
You have to be able to perceive the future.
No, more than that. If I was a prophet and I could perceive the future, that still would not mean that I was experiencing time as Yud-He and Vav-He. It would mean that I'm experiencing time in past, present, and past. It means that I'm in the present. I can predict the future, but it doesn't mean that I'm in the future. It means that I can see the future. Just because I have a crystal ball doesn't mean that I am now experiencing both present, past, and future. Hold on for a second. I'm asking you this question. Listen very carefully. I'm asking to you the following. People experience time in a linear fashion. We go through it. We perceive ourselves going through it. Actually, if you read modern astrophysics, you will realize that time is actually, in real life, not so linear after all. But living in the world as we know it, we are condemned to experience time in a linear fashion, right? Past, present, and future. Okay. But what this word seems to suggest is that that's not the way God experiences time. If you want to know what it means to be God, what it means to be God is to have an experience of time that is Yud-He and Vav-He, which means that past, present, and future all mushkababble together, and it's one thing, and that's what it means to be God. Okay? Now, what perspective would you have on time in order for that to be real? What being, what qualities would a being have to experience time that way? Where would he need to be? Right. You have to be outside of time. If you're inside of time, you're going through the tunnel. There's past, present, and future. You need to be outside of that tunnel, right, in order to experience time where there's no difference, where you are simultaneously in past, present, and future. Now, what that means to say that God is outside of time, who is outside of time? What relationship, what are the implications of saying that there is a being that is outside of time? There's only one being that is outside of time, and that is the creator of time. Right? In other words, what Yud-He and Vav-He suggests is that there is a realm of existence that is not accessible to us. Right? There's a realm of existence which we are inside this tunnel called time. There's a realm of existence that's outside of that. Why? Because obviously the being that created the tunnel doesn't live in the tunnel, right? In other words, let me be very clear about this. One of the things you read, if you read any of these books about the creation of the universe and astrophysics, is that something very non-intuitive happened at the moment of the Big Bang. You see, we tend to think that what happened at the moment of the Big Bang, what was created at the moment of the Big Bang? What was created is all the matter in the universe was created. Wrong. That is not the only thing that was created in the Big Bang. What else was created besides all the universe, all the matter that ever exists? Time and space. Space and time themselves are created in the Big Bang, which is why the correct answer to the child's question, what is outside of the expanding universe, is nothing. Because space itself is the limits of the universe. The Big Bang, constantly pushing itself outward, is literally a stretching of space and time. There is no time outside of the Big Bang's constantly expanding domain, and there is no space outside of that. Now, you say, Foreman's off his rocker. How could that be? This concludes tape 3 in the series Exodus from Egypt, The Hidden Agenda. The series is continued at this point on tape 4.